Mr. Baker, of course. And the next case for argument, Hughes v. Astru. Mr. Marvin.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Cody Marvin on behalf of the plaintiff appellant Patricia Hughes. This is a Social Security disability case in which the ALJ made several errors. We raised three arguments, the first of which is that the ALJ incorrectly rejected the opinion of Dr. Elms, who was a consultative examiner who the ALJ sent Ms. Hughes to see. At the hearing, the ALJ explained, based on the record he had, he didn't have a basis for a residual functional capacity assessment. The evaluations in the file prior to that were, there were two evaluations from state agency doctors, both of whom said there was no severe impairment, and there were a couple of other opinions from treating or examining sources. The ALJ said, this isn't enough for me to go on. I don't know what to do, so I'm going to send you to this examiner. The examiner did a 90-minute examination and took x-rays. These were the first x-rays that had been done. There were no x-rays prior to this in the file. Based on the examination, Dr. Elms gave her some pretty significant restrictions. And in addition to that...
And he was the first one to suggest the rotator cuff disorder.
Correct. There was... going back to 2002, she had a different disorder of the shoulder, the adhesive capsulitis, the frozen shoulder, right?
And everybody seems to be confusing range of motion and strength, which are not the same thing.
Correct. One thing the ALJ said is that, a primary reason for her claim was that she didn't have range of motion of the shoulder, which she did. She got that back after physical therapy, but she continued to have pain.
Were any objective medical tests done that... measured her muscle strength, or
yes.
Was that limitation, based more on her reports?
No, there were tests done. Actually, the most recent evidence in the file was it wasn't the most recent. It was just before the examination was done. But there was a physical therapy note. This is at pages 481 to 83. Said that the strength in her shoulders was 3+ out of 5. 3 out of 5 means that you can move against gravity. 4 out of 5 means that you can move against some pressure from the examiner. So there was some objective evidence that she was significantly weakened in the shoulders.
Can you explain to me what Dr. Guralnick meant when she said that Hughes was having difficulty grasping the severity of her disease?
I believe that was about the COPD.
Does that mean she's overstating it or she's understating it? I can't make any sense out of that remark.
I wasn't exactly sure either what the doctor meant by that. I'm sorry, I don't know that I can clarify.
All right.
Yes, as you said, Dr. Elms was the first one to notice that she had this degenerative rotator cuff problem, which I believe was the source of the pain. Now, the ALJ didn't really deal with that in the decision. There's one mention of that when reciting Dr. Elms' report, but beyond that, doesn't really acknowledge that this was a severe impairment or that it could cause pain or really analyze and explain whether this could cause those limitations.
So let me ask you what you think, and you might say both, but whatever, what you think the key point is, because I see two things in this case. One of them is your challenge to the residual functional capacity. And the other is your argument about attention being paid to her past relevant work, and particularly this night clerk job. So what are you really focusing on? If the residual functional capacity was wrong, then everything else falls out anyway. But even if it's right, there's this work issue.
Correct. I think in regards to the second point, the ALJ did not follow Social Security ruling 8262, which requires that the ALJ go through and get a detailed explanation of what the requirements of a person's past work were.
So you mean, in other words, I'm wondering whether this has to do with level of generality, because the commissioner's response to this argument of yours is that the job looks a lot like the description in the DOT. But I guess what I'm inferring that you're arguing is that you need to dig in a little bit more to the details of what that particular job was. Obviously, the Dictionary of Occupational Terms is written for the entire national economy, and every job may have a bit of difference.
Correct. And as I pointed out in a reply brief, the particular job she had, that job performed in a smaller establishment is actually a combination job, which is performed at the light level of exertion, which requires lifting 20 pounds, which, based on this residual functional capacity, she wasn't capable of doing.
So even the ALJ agrees she can't lift 20 pounds. She's
right,
not at
right.
the light
so,
exertional level.
So had the ALJ really gotten into that and evaluated that, may have come to the conclusion that she wasn't capable of doing that either.
And is there any evidence in the record indicating that her respiratory impairment would limit her ability to do her past job without considering her shoulder impairment?
Yes. The opinion from Dr. Elms says that she should not have any exposure to pulmonary irritants, dust, fumes, that sort of thing. And she did explain that she... even when she was working as the night audit clerk, she had difficulty with pollution and with fumes and that sort of thing. So if Dr. Elms' opinion were accepted, then she likely would not have been able to do that job either. Also, with regard to the credibility, one issue was that the ALJ said that she continued to smoke despite the COPD. But it appears that she did not actually continue to smoke. She stopped smoking, I believe, in 1978 or something.
The commissioner more or less concedes that that was an error. They just
yeah.
say it's a harmless error.
Correct. So our argument is that the error is not harmless, and there are two main reasons. First, we don't know to what extent the ALJ relied on that in making the credibility determination. If that was a significant point, this court said in Miles v. Astrew that if there's some mistake of fact in the credibility determination, that enough is reason to remand. In addition to that, had the ALJ not made that mistake, it's possible he would have accepted Dr. Elms' opinion as regards the pulmonary irritants and so forth.
So maybe you could say a word about this debate about the fact that the ALJ's RFC doesn't seem to track any particular medical evidence in the record. You say in your reply brief a couple of times you're not saying that it has to, but how does it have to relate to the medical evidence in the record?
So what the commissioner says, or how the commissioner interprets our argument, is that the ALJ has to select a single opinion from the record and adopt that in its entirety. That's not what we were arguing, and that's not the law. What does have to happen is the ALJ has to have some basis in the record, whether it's medical opinion, some other medical evidence, the person's testimony.
So it could be cut and paste, though. You know, one doctor says she can work for 5 hours a day sitting, and somebody else says that she can, walk two blocks or whatever the kinds of evidence.
I mean, the important thing is that it needs to be supported in the record. This court has said in a few cases, in Briscoe v. Barnhart, Scott v. Estrue, Swede v. Estrue, there has to be some basis. The ALJ can't basically just make it up. It has to point to something in the record showing that the person is actually capable of doing each of the things in the RFC assessment. I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Goldstein?
May it please the Court. The administrative law judge did not state at the hearing that there was no basis for the RFC or residual functional capacity at the time of the hearing and when he said he was going to get a consultative examination. It's also important to understand that what the administrative law judge did in this case, he has a way of addressing or of talking. So later on page 54 of the record, he says he may not discount medical opinions, but we know that's not the law. And at the end of that paragraph, he goes on to discount the opinions in the record because they weren't supported.
Do ALJs get any, the Social Security Administration, do they get any medical training?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know what training the ALJs get. I've never been at ALJ, Administrative Law Judge training. I assume there's some, but I don't know.
What medical evidence in the record would contradict the conclusion of Dr. Elms that she had decreased muscle strength?
Well, it was her own statements, for one. She said repeatedly she could lift up to 10 pounds.
But she didn't say all day. I mean, she's very careful to say, you know, kind of she can muster up her strength. That's how she describes her job as a night clerk, maybe to move the coffee urn. Coffee urns can be heavy, by the way, you know, because, you know, if it's 2 or 3 gallons of coffee, that's actually a fair amount of weight. That's way more than 10 pounds. And she has to adjust things. So I'm not sure that her full testimony is, in fact, supportive that she can deal with 10 pounds.
Well, her testimony is she can lift up to 10 pounds, and sedentary work requires lifting up to 10 pounds. It doesn't require frequent lifting.
But a third of the day.
No, I don't believe that the definition of sedentary work is okay, is not occasional. It's just lifting up to 10 pounds. I don't believe it's a third of the day. But even if the definition of sedentary work is lifting up to a third of the day, 10 pounds, the record as a whole supports this ability.
Now, are you relying on her daily activities? Because I think there's a huge problem if you are.
We're relying on a number of things, including the regulatory sanctioned or the regulatory directed consideration of daily activities, yes.
But the daily activities that she describes would not get you through this job as a night clerk.
In and of itself, certainly not. But as an element that she can vacuum, for instance, that she can cook that, those.
But
the
what
LJ
if she
can
vacuum and then she has to lie down for an hour and take a nap?
But she didn't say that.
Well, she more or less does say that she's got to, you know, reduce the amount in her laundry bag. She's got to.
At one point she said that. At the hearing she said that, but she didn't say that anywhere else. She said she could do all these other things, and she never qualified her ability to do that.
But, you know, I mean, even taking the assessment that she can carry up to 10 pounds. How could she do her past work, given that her description of that work includes that she sometimes was required to lift 30 pounds?
No, that was a different job, Your Honor. That was a job as a clerk. There were two jobs.
I know. But
she only has to do one.
I'm just talking about in toto.
The ALJ didn't distinguish, by the way, but yes.
No, but we're conceding that she can't perform the job where she said she had to lift up to 30 pounds. But she's still not disabled if she can perform the other job.
But how do you know, since there's no careful examination of the night clerk job, so we don't know how heavy those coffee urns were. We don't know how often she had to carry linens to people's rooms. We don't know the critical details.
And there's two elements to past work, Your Honor. That's why there's actually performed. And there's generally performed. And we know that the Dictionary of Occupational Titles job description, which she submitted, says that a night clerk is sedentary work. It also says,
not all night clerk jobs are exactly the same.
They don't.
And she's pointing out that the job, her past relevant work, might not have been.
You're correct, Your Honor, that all exactly the same. But that's why there's two distinctions
I don't understand this. So why couldn't the administrative law judge forget about her ability to perform a previous job and just say she's not disabled because she can do other sedentary work?
Well, perhaps he could have, but
he didn't.
He didn't.
And there's no.
What do you mean when you say, you know, we've criticized this ridiculous template of your agency, which has gotten worse. Claimants' medical determinable impairments could reasonably be expected to cause the alleged. However, statements are not credible to the extent they are consistent with the above RFC assessment, which invariably comes later. So you say in your brief on page 35, while the court in Bjornsson certainly criticized the template, it ultimately ordered the agency to take a close look at the utility and intelligibility of its templates. And then you say, and the agency has done just that. What do you mean by that?
It means that because of the time lag, there's thousands of cases in the pipeline.
What has it done? I know.
Has it done?
The agency has done something. What has it done?
We've consulted. We've consulted with the administrative law judges division, the ODAR, Office of Disability Education and Adjudication and Review, and we've conveyed to them the court's concerns.
And what was their response?
Since I didn't convey them, I don't know.
Okay. I'm sure it's nothing. I'm sure it's a zero response.
But hope not.
I'm bothered. This is another aspect of the Bjornsson opinion. This business of the heavy reliance that these ALJs put on the non-work, what people do in their homes, that's a completely different environment from a job, right? You're at home. You have to live. You can't starve to death. You may have physical or mental problems, so you do what you can. But of course, you do it at your own schedule, right? You're not spending 8 hours in an office somewhere. You do it when you can. You try to lighten the work. There's evidence here about how she doesn't carry full pots of things and so on. I don't know why they... I mean, it's one thing if the person is playing football in his backyard, right? That I would understand. It's highly germane to an argument that you were incapable of working. But just because you live at home rather than an institution, and therefore you have to do some cooking and you carry things occasionally, I don't know how that bears on your ability to do a job.
I understand the court's concern. The regulations say that when assessing credibility, consider activities of daily living.
But
you
consider.
Can consider it. But why not be realistic about the differences between the physical tasks you do in your home, at your own schedule, with whatever adjustments are necessary to make it possible, and at your own pace and so on, and what you'd have to do in a job. Couldn't they ever say in their opinions, well, we realize there's a difference between the way you can pace yourself at home and adjust the jobs and so on, and what you do. And the other thing we've pointed out in cases to which the ALJs pay absolutely no attention is that, although it sounds like a contradiction, people can actually work beyond their capacity, right, if they're desperate. And even if you're not desperate enough to do a job that you're physically incapable of doing, still you might live at home and do things that are very difficult for you because you want to live at home and you don't want to be an institution. And you could still be disabled even though you're limping around your house and carrying things, right? Where's the recognition of that?
Well, the statute, Your Honor, says that a person must be unable to work. It doesn't...
But we know we've had cases where we've said this person is totally disabled. In fact, he's working. Now, sometimes it's because you've got a nice employer who says, I know you're disabled and you can't do the job, but, I'll employ you anyway. And we've had cases where we've reversed the Social Security Administration because, oh, you're working. Well, that means you can't be disabled. And similarly, there are cases where people really are disabled. They shouldn't be working, but they want the money, so they work, but they're still disabled.
Should I address briefly the question? The regulations address the nice employer condition, but in this case, she stated two reasons why she left work at different places. One, to move to Chicago, and one, because she didn't want to be left without a job, so she wanted to stop work before her employer closed. She never said except at her hearing, perhaps, but that she never, in contemporaneous real-time records, she never said she left work because of her disabilities.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Goldstein. So, Mr. Marvin, do you have anything further?
Unless there are any questions, I have nothing more to add.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel. Next case.